That is not what we just discussed, is not going to
Not
impact this at all,
affect
right?
that. Yes. No problem. No problem. Okay, let's open in prayer first. Father, thank you for this day and this time together that we have here. We thank you for all your blessings. Be with us tonight. Speak to our hearts in Jesus' name. Amen. I made some, I was going over, let's put it that way, the passages that I had singled out during my earlier reading of Second Kings that had to do with prayer.
So we're
And I
done with
got,
First Kings.
yeah,
Okay.
I got on set. I started, the first one is Second Kings 4, which primarily talks about Elisha's encounter with the Shunammite woman during the time of Ahab. And it struck me that it was exactly like something we studied last time, and which was First Kings 17. Now, basically, First Kings, although it talks about the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah, just like Elijah does, they're always interacting with the king, the different kings. But it primarily focuses on Elijah. And when it goes through the entire life of Elijah, and then when Second Kings begins, we're dealing with Elisha. And so what you have in First Kings 17 is the story about a woman, and you have a story about a woman and the prophet in 2 Kings 4, and they're structured almost identically. And as I was going through, what I did is I tried to write down what the common points were, and as I was doing it, I realized there's a third parallel, and that's between the teachings of Jesus. So I thought we could look at this. I know we're going to be re-reviewing 1 Kings 17, but we don't need to, I don't think we need to reread it, but I do think we should read 2 Kings 4. And you'll probably start, just from what I've said, you'll start to pick up on a lot of these parallels yourself. Just think in terms of Elijah earlier and some of the things that are described in the Gospels that might be related to what we're reading. 2 Kings 4. Okay. It says, a certain woman, the wife of one of the disciples of the prophets, cried out to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband, is dead. And you know how your servant revered the Lord. And now a creditor is coming to seize my two children as slaves." Elisha said to her, "What can I do for you? Tell me, what have you in the house?" She replied, "Your maidservant has nothing at all in the house except a jug of oil. Go," he said, "and borrow vessels outside from all your neighbors, empty vessels as many as you can. Then go in and shut the door behind you and your children and pour oil into all those vessels, removing each one as it is filled." She went away and shut the door behind her and her children. They kept bringing vessels to her and she kept pouring. When the vessels were full, she said to her son, "Bring me another vessel." He answered her, "There are no more vessels," and the oil stopped. She came and told the man of God, and he said, "Go sell the oil, pay your debt, and you and your children can live off the rest." One day, Elisha visited Shunem. A wealthy woman lived there, and she urged him to have a meal. And whenever he passed by, he would stop there for a meal. Once she said to her husband, "I'm sure it's a holy man of God who comes this way regularly. Let us make a small enclosed upper chamber and place a bed, a table, a chair, and a lampstand there for him so that he can stop there whenever he comes to us." One day he came there. He retired to the upper chamber and lay down there. He said to his servant Gehazi, "Call that Shunammite woman." He called her and she stood before him. He said to him, "Tell her, you have gone to all this trouble for us. What can we do for you? Can we speak in your behalf to the king or to the army commander?" She replied, "I live among my own people. What then can be done for her?" he asked. The fact is, said Gehazi, she has no son and her husband is old. Call her, he said. He called her and she stood in the doorway. And Elisha said, at this season next year, you will be embracing a son. She replied, please, my Lord, man of God, do not delude your maidservant. The woman conceived and bore a son at the same season the following year, as Elisha had assured her. The child grew up. One day he went out to his father among the reapers. Suddenly he cried to his father, oh, my head, my head. He said to a servant, carry him to his mother. He picked him up and brought him to his mother, and the child sat on her lap until noon, and he died. She took him up and laid him on the bed of the man of God and left him and closed the door. Then she called to her husband, please send me one of the servants and one of the she-asses so I can hurry to the man of God and back. But he said, why are you going to him today? It's neither the new moon nor the Sabbath. She answered, it's all right. She had the ass saddled and said to her servant, urge the beast on. See that I don't slow down unless I tell you. She went on until she came to the man of God on Mount Carmel. When the man of God saw her from afar, he said to his servant Gehazi, there's that Shunammite woman. Go hurry toward her and ask her, how are you? How is your husband? How is the child? We are well, she replied. But when she came up to the man of God on the mountain, she clasped his feet. Gehazi stepped forward to push her away. But the man of God said, let her alone, for she is in bitter distress, and the Lord has hidden it from me and not told me. Then she said, did I ask my Lord for a son? Didn't I say, don't mislead me? He said to Gehazi, tie up your skirts, take my staff in your hand, and go. If you meet anyone, do not greet him. And if anyone greets you, do not answer him. And place my staff on the face of the boy. But the boy's mother said, as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you. So he arose and followed her. Gehazi had gone on before them and had placed the staff on the boy's face. But there was no sound or response. He turned back to meet him and told him, the boy is not awakened. Elisha came into the house and there was the boy laid out dead on his couch. He went in, shut the door behind the two of them, and prayed to the Lord. Then he mounted the bed and placed himself over the child. He put his mouth on its mouth, his eyes on its eyes, and his hands on its hands, and he bent over it. And the body of the child became warm. He stepped down, walked up and down the room, then mounted the bed over him. Thereupon the boy sneezed 7 times, and the boy opened his eyes. Elisha called Gehazi and said, call the Shunammite woman. And he called her. When she came to him, he said, pick up your son. She came and fell at his feet and bowed low to the ground. Then she picked up her son and left. Going to stop there. You have any thoughts, John, from just
As
reading that?
to what parallels from the Gospels?
Maybe that's too hard to way to put it. It's kind of hard to, you'll see it maybe if we do this. Here's how I broke down the story in 1 Kings 17. And I am going to refer back to that just a minute because we have to follow the verses maybe.
Well, I
Verse
saw.
17.
Go ahead.
No, you no, in 1 Kings 17, the story is about Elijah and during the famine, when the word of the Lord came to him and told him to go to the brook Cherith where the ravens would feed him. And then it says in verse 7, after some time the wadi dried up because there was no rain in the land. And the word of the Lord came to him, go at once to Zarephath of Sidon and stay there. I have designated a widow there to feed you. So he went at once to Zarephath. When he came to the entrance of the town, a widow was there gathering wood. He called out to her, please bring me a As the Lord God your lives, she replied, I have nothing baked, nothing but a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. I'm just gathering a couple of sticks so that I can go home and prepare it for me and my son. We shall eat it and then we shall die. You have two. One, Elisha's woman is not a widow, but the woman of Zarephath and her have one thing in common. They both have a desperate need. The desperate need of the woman is that she has nothing. She has nothing but a jug of oil in the house. And a little bit of, I guess, flour so that she can make some bread. She's, a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. The woman that Elisha is dealing, there, well, here's the thing that's you have to get over. There's the same structure, but there's two stories in 2 Kings. The two stories combined have the same structure. The first story is actually, if you combine the first story with the second story, you get the sequential picture of what was going on in 1 Kings. Because here you have the woman, wife of one of the disciples of the prophets, and her husband's dead, so she's a widow too. And her desperate need is again poverty, just like the first one woman's. And all she has is oil. She doesn't even have the flour. But in both case, I think in both cases, doesn't do they does the prophet ask, "What do you have?" I know in Elisha does. He, let me look at a verse in chapter 1 Kings 17 again. I'm going to go back and forth a little bit.
I think he just says, go and make me a bread first.
Yeah, she replied, "I have nothing but a handful of flour and a little oil." All he says is, "Yeah, just go and bake me a little bit first." So, but once again, what I didn't include in my notes, but I saw here when we were looking at this story now, is how Elisha says to her, "What do you have? What have you in the house?" It's that, "What is in thy hand?" Like God spoke to Moses. The thing, that concept keeps coming over and over again, where God works with the little that we have. He takes it and works with that. But the second, so that's the first commonality. In the Gospels, there are women in desperate need too. There's the woman who had the issue of blood from Matthew 9. There is the nobleman in John 4 whose son had died. And then there's the ruler in Matthew 9 and Mark 5, the story's told twice, whose daughter dies, has died. And in each case, they're coming to Jesus with the same kind of desperate plea that you're going to see the second woman in this passage from 2 Kings, who has a son who dies. So I thought that was interesting. The next thing that I notice in this story, and it's common to both, is that the source of the supply, the oil or the oil and the flour, is secretly replenished. And by secretly, I mean there's no obvious explanation of what's going on. And it's secret also in that it's done inside the house where nobody can see it. In fact, I believe Elisha tells the woman, "Go in and shut the door behind you." This is so she's pouring the oil out, and as much as she pours out, it keeps filling the vessels. They bring a vessel, fills it up, bring a vessel, fills it up. With Elijah, she makes the cake for Elijah first, and every time she goes to the jar for the flour and the oil, or the jars, there's flour and oil for as long as the famine lasts. As soon as the fa flat famine is over, it says the oil stop. Okay, the Gospels. What's the most obvious
Well,
parallel?
Jesus feeding
Feeding
the
the
5,000.
5,000,
Yeah.
right? Of
Right.
course. And
How he took the fish and the bread and just kept on multiplying and multiplying and
and
multiplying. Yeah.
so I think we're going to see, we'll look at that a little further down, but right now what I want to look at is the source of the supply secretly being replenished. Where in the Gospels do you see that? You do see it in the feeding of the 5,000, because there's no explanation of how the bread can keep being broken and never be exhausted. But there's another place. John, the wedding in
The
Cana,
wine.
the wine. And
Yeah, I
it's
was thinking about that.
very, very similar. In fact, I think we should take a look at that in John 2, because it's worth, I think it's worth looking.
That was going to be something that I was thinking about then, the wine.
So in John 2, it says, "On the third day, there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And both Jesus was called and his disciples to the marriage. And when they wanted wine, the mother of Jesus saith unto him, They have no wine. Jesus saith unto her, Woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet come. His mother saith unto the servants, Whatsoever he saith unto you, do it. And there were set there six water pots of stone, after the manner of the purifying of the Jews, containing two or three firkins apiece. Jesus saith, And then fill the water pots with water. And they filled them up to the brim. And he saith unto them, Draw it now, and bear it unto the governor of the feast. And they bear it. When the ruler of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, and knew not whence it was, but the servants which drew the water knew, the governor of the feast called the bridegroom, and saith unto him, Every man at the beginning to set forth good wine, and when men have well drunk, then that which is worse. But thou hast kept the good wine until now. This beginning of miracles did Jesus in Cana of Galilee, and manifested forth his glory, and his disciples believed on him. So it's similar. There's no real, nobody knew where that wine came from. They thought it was real. They thought it was, the governor thought it was better than what was being served originally.
Yeah.
The other thing, since, let me see here, something I'm getting lost here. Looking at my note. Okay. So we had the feeding. I want to look at the secretly replenished. I want to look at the feeding of the multitude too, or let's talk about that too, because it is definitely a part of what transpired there.
Was that John 6 or?
I believe, I know I had a note here somewhere on this, that story is repeated in there's one isn't that story in every single one of the Gospels?
Yes.
Isn't that amazing? And
Yeah.
it's in there twice in Matthew and Mark. I mean, there's two feedings. That's maybe this one, all of them. I know John 6 is the one. But what I was been what impressed me that was similar to, besides the source, was the fact that there was no waste. Remember when in the feeding of the 5,000, if you look at John 6:12, since we have John open here,
Fragments that remain so that nothing is lost.
that says nothing is lost. First Kings, the fact that the oil continued until the famine stopped. On the day the famine stopped, the oil stopped. There was no need for the oil anymore to be replenished, so it stopped at that point. And in Second Kings, once the vessels are full and there are no more vessels, the oil stops. It doesn't keep flowing because there's not no vessel to receive it. In so you have it in all three sources. Now, one of the obvious things that's common is that the sun dies in Elijah 17 and the sun dies in 2 Kings 4. So I also was considering, well, where are there deaths in the Gospels? And it's the ones that we've talked about earlier, the healing of the nobleman's son, the resurrection of the dead, I guess, of the nobleman's son, and of the ruler's daughter, and also the resurrection of Lazarus, which, so those three are similar. There's another thing, commonality in and that is that there's an appeal to the justice of God. And I'll explain what I mean by that. First Kings 17 and verse 20. I'll look at that. Just look, keep pulling my marker up. When Elijah finds out, when Elijah goes to pray to the Lord, he tells the Lord, "Oh Lord, my God, will you bring calamity upon this widow whose guest I am and let her son die?" In other words, Elijah is somewhat indebted to this woman for the kindness that she's been showing to him, which is also a similarity in these stories. The because in Second Kings, Elisha, here this was Elijah was indebted for the hospitality, but Elisha also is the woman prepares a room for him. She gives him food every time he comes. And I think you see it in John also. If you look at the story of the laying of ra raising of Lazarus in John 12, the first couple of verses. You can find John 12, verses 1 and 2. And then says, then Jesus, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, which had been dead, whom he raised from the dead. There they made him a supper, and Martha served, but Lazarus was one of them that sat at the table with him. There was another reference. Where did I see that? Concerning Martha. There's a verse in John, maybe it's John 11. No.
What's the verse that you're referring to?
It's where it says that Martha served. Okay, let's look at
Oh,
11:1. Now, a certain man was sick named Lazarus. That's what I just read.
you're talking about Martha and Mary, and Martha or Mary saying, or Martha was saying, tell Mary to help me.
Yeah, but there's an earlier verse that refers to Martha too. And I have lost.
You're saying, I know that he will be raised again at the resurrection? That?
No, how could I have lost this?
I know that Martha's in John 11:20.
You know what I'm going to do, John? I'm going to do a quick look up here.
All right.
Because I can find it easier. The way I found it the first time, I just typed in Martha in my electronic concordance. And I'll try that again. And it should be. It no, it is. It's in Luke 10, verse 38. Now it came to pass as as they went, that he entered into a certain village, and a certain woman named Martha received him into her house, and she had a sister called Mary, which also sat at his feet and heard his word. Well, that's the same one that says taken. Huh. Okay. In verse 2 of John 12, it says, there they made him a supper and Martha served. But obviously, there's some reference there to Mary and Martha ministering to Jesus and his physical needs. Okay, I'm going to let it go at that.
Are you talking about the John 12 where Mary takes the oil and anoints Jesus with it?
Yeah, well, maybe I'm there's that too. You know, I was thinking it's like Martha ministers to Jesus' physical needs and Mary ministers love, for him. In both cases, they're ministering to him, but it's a slightly, it's of a different nature. In fact, Jesus tells Martha, you're concerned about many things, but Mary's found the important thing.
And the better one, yeah.
Yes. Point I'm trying to make is in prayer, it's very often you see the stories in the Bible where someone makes appeal to God for something based on what they know about God, what his nature is. And I think what Elisha is doing, and even what Elijah did, I'll show you another reference when we do the parallel there, is to make this appeal based on the fact, look, these women have been doing good to me. which, since I'm your servant, it's as if they're doing it on your behalf for me. So there's a kind of just obligation to recompense them. And in fact, that's what Elisha says to when he's sitting in his room, he calls his servant and he says, "Bring the Shunammite up to us. There must be something we can do for her since she showed us all this kindness in making this room for us." And she tells him, "No, there's nothing you can do." And then he volunteers to fulfill what he knows is a real need there, and that is the need for a son. And he prophesies to her that she'll have a son, and she says, "Don't deceive me." That's why when she comes to him, she said, "Didn't I tell you not to deceive me?" The implied message here is, you gave me this, and now you take, it's being taken away. What kind of a gift is that? So Elisha's appealing to God in along those lines. Let me see if I can find my. They printed out both chapters. Really bad. No. The thought that comes to mind is the will you return evil for good? And that's a concept that you see in the Bible a lot.
Thinking about is, I think a lot there was examples of Abraham and Moses praying like that to God as well, appealing to his character.
Yes, definitely. Abraham, with the destruction of Sodom, would you destroy the town if they'd find 10 righteous people in it? Like offhand, I'm sure there was for Moses too.
Yeah, the one where he says, what would they say about you that you brought these people out here just to
Right, just to have
destroy them,
them
and that
destroyed.
it would be a negative reflection upon you
Right.
if you were to do that. So
Yeah.
I think that's a very effective
Yeah.
way of praying.
In Proverbs 7, well, probably it's worthwhile looking at 1 Samuel because this is a short little story that mentions this concept. And it's when David encounters Saul after Saul's been hunting him down. In chapter 24 of 1 Samuel. And as you know, remember, Saul went into the cave where David was hiding. And when he didn't realize it, David snuck up behind him and cut off a corner of his garment. And he did this instead of killing him because his commander of the army was saying, "Well, here's God's delivered your enemy into your hands. Why don't you kill him?" But he wouldn't do that because he respected the fact that he was God, Saul was God's anointed. Instead, he just cut off that corner. And even that caused him to feel some guilt later on. After he does that, he comes out of the cave and reveals himself to Saul. And in verse 8, you have the dialogue. It says, "David rebuked his men and did not permit them to attack Saul. Saul left the cave and started on his way. Then David also went out of the cave and called after Saul, saying, 'My lord king.' Saul looked around. David bowed low in homage with his face to the ground. And David said to Saul, 'Why do you listen to the people who say David is out to do you harm? You can see for yourself now that the Lord delivered you into my hands in the cave today, and though I was urged to kill you, I showed you pity. For I said, I will not raise a hand against my Lord, since he is the Lord's anointed. Please, sir, take a close look at the corner of your cloak in my hand. For when I cut off the corner of your cloak, I did not kill you. You must see plainly that I've done nothing evil or rebellious, and I've never wronged you. Yet you're bent on taking my life. May the Lord judge between you and me, and may he take vengeance upon you for me, but my hand will never touch you. As the ancient proverb has it, wicked deeds come from wicked men. My hand will never touch you. Against whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom are you pursuing? A dead dog? A single flea? May the Lord be arbiter, and may he judge between you and me. May he take note and uphold my cause and vindicate me against you. When David finished saying these things to Saul, Saul said, "Is that your voice, my son David?" And Saul broke down and wept. He said to David, "You are right, not I, for you have treated me generously, but I have treated you badly. Yes, you've just revealed how generously you treated me, for the Lord delivered me into your hands, and you did not kill me. If a man meets his enemy, does he let him go his way unharmed? Surely the Lord will reward you generously for what you have done for me. This day, I know that you will become king and that the kingship over Israel will remain in your hands. So swear to me by the Lord, you will not destroy my descendants or wipe out my name from my father's house." David swore to Saul. Saul went home, and David and his men went up to the strongholds. So David did not reward evil for evil, but he rewarded evil with good. Proverbs 17, verse 13.
Okay.
You read that, John?
What, it was Proverbs 17,
Yeah.
verse 17?
13.
Oh, 13, yeah. Whoever rewards evil for good, evil will not depart from his house.
Now, when I'm in the Gospels, Jesus makes this even stronger. I'm thinking of Matthew 5, verses 43 through 48.
But the
Because he not only
Beatitudes.
says that God won't reward good with evil, but he says God will reward good for those who do, even for those who do. He treats the even the evil with good, as opposed to treating the evil with evil. And he certainly doesn't, bring evil upon people who are doing good. And he says that to be or to reflect the fact that we are children of God, we should behave like him. And in verse 43, he says, "You've heard that it's been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the just unjust. If ye love them which love you, what reward have you? Do not even the publicans the same? And if you salute your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Be therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect." And then finally, I'm going to read 1 Thessalonians 5:15, where Paul says, "See that none render evil for evil unto any man, but ever follow that which is good, both among yourselves and to all men." So that's the pattern for God. And I think both Elisha and Elijah recognize this principle and are using that as a basis in their prayers to secure a response from the Lord. Now, the other thing that's common is that a specific request is made to God in each case. In verse 21 of chapter 17, Elijah prays specifically for the woman's son. In the story in 2 Kings, actually, it's the woman who comes and makes her request to Elisha, but Elisha also prays for the son specifically. Because it says, that he went in and shut the door behind the two of them and prayed to the Lord. Now, he doesn't just pray. Well, in 1 Kings 17, Elijah prays not just once, but three times. The first, he had to pray three times before he got an answer. Elisha doesn't pray three times, but he performs two acts after he makes the prayer before there's a response. He goes in and he it says he put his mouth on his mouth and his eyes on his eyes, and the body of the child becomes warm and doesn't rise from the dead. Then he steps down from the bed, walks up and down once around the room, and then he goes back on the bed, bent over him, and thereupon the boy sneezed seven times, and the boy opened his eyes. What I'm seeing in both of these cases is this importunity. In other words, the not giving up right away, because Jesus gave several parables about that and teachings about that.
You know, these stories between Elisha and Elijah are so similar that I think I had just
Assume
conflated
the same thing.
the two.
Yeah.
I
Isn't
mean,
that amazing?
yeah, and I didn't even realize that until we're having this discussion right now.
You
And
know,
I
that's not
read
the
these.
only it's not the only time this happens. And then even some of these stories that are so similar, like the feeding of the 5,000, and I'm saying, why are there two or three times in the Bible where we see the identical story? And the thought came to me, the verse, in the mouth of two or three witnesses shall every word be established. It's like, why do we have four instances of the feeding of the 5,000 in the Gospels?
Yeah.
It's to
Mean, it's
reinforce the
weird that
importance.
Elijah stretched himself out on the dead child, and then Elisha, his protege, kind of did the exact same thing.
With the oh yeah.
I mean, it's almost so similar that, yeah, I just kind of joined them in my mind as one
Yeah.
story.
Now, part of the reason that the practice may be similar, so similar, I think I learned this from listening to a couple of a Jewish rabbi talk about this. You notice in 2 Kings that when the woman comes to Elijah, said in the first verse, it says, a certain woman, the wife of one of the disciples of the prophets, came to Elijah. This is part of the indebtedness, too. In essence, this woman is saying, I'm in desperate straits now because my husband is dead, but he was your disciple, or he, and to that extent, I lost the benefit of his support. And now he's dead. You owe me. At least that's how I'm reading into this. But the reason I think the practices are so similar is there was what is known as these prophets, they had disciples. It was like a school. There were practices that the prophets passed on that you did to affect certain causes. And so I think that's what you're seeing Elisha do. The reason it's similar is because he learned it from Elijah. Elijah.
Amazing.
So let's see, where are we now?
Yeah, the stories are just so similar.
They're very similar. But you definitely have what I'm getting out of this is they don't give up. They on the first instance, they continue in prayer, and that reminds me of all of the stories and or the teachings of Jesus about Luke, Luke 18, the parables. It says that Jesus told the story to illustrate that men ought always to pray and not to faint. And he talks about the unjust judge who wouldn't listen to the plea because he was just, but because the person kept persistently asking for justice. And finally, he figured that was the best way to solve the problem. And then there's the story that the parable Jesus tells about the neighbor who has a guest come and he wants to borrow some food, and it's the middle of the night. And he knocks on his neighbor's door and asks him, and the guy says, "Go away, it's the middle of the night," but he keeps doing it. And eventually the guy gets up and gives him the food. So and those stories weren't just told to be cute stories. The point was that we should be persistent and, follow, don't just give up at the first seeming non-answer to our prayers.
Right.
So those are the this let's see one other this, there's two other things that were not parallels with both stories, but they were parallels with the gospel, and I just want to bring them out. In the Elisha story, there's two things that you don't see in the Elijah story, and one of the first one is that Gehazi, when he's sent to lay the staff on top of the boy's face, he comes back and he says the boy's still asleep. He fails. What does that remind you of in the Gospels?
When the disciples couldn't cast out the demons.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. These are good parallels.
Now, here's another one. The feeding of the people in Elisha in chapter 4. I believe it's in chapter the first story. No, it's the next one. I think it's where is this? Let me look. In the next story, verse 42, it says a man came from Baal Shalisha, and he brought the man of God some bread of the first reaping, 20 loaves of barley bread and some fresh grain in his sack. And Elisha said, "Give it to the people and let them eat." His attendant replied, "How can I set this before 100 men?" But he said, "Give it to the people and let them eat. For thus said the Lord, they shall eat and have some left over." So he set it before them. When they'd eaten, they had some left over, as the Lord had said. Now that is so
Amazing.
close to the story of
Yeah.
the feeding of 500. They
Yeah.
asked the same question, "How can I feed all these people?"
I know. He's like, what? Shall I
And
set
there's
this
some
before
left over.
100 men?
Yeah.
That's really amazing.
It's similar too. That's they bring there in each of the stories. There's two of the two stories in the Gospels. There's different quantities of the material. I think in all cases there's bread brought, right?
Yes.
But in one case, there's fish also. And there's different quantities. But here
I
it's
thought
not.
that both had fish and bread, but they were different quantities. And there was one
Maybe.
with 7,000 and one with
Okay.
5,000.
Yeah. Okay. In this case, it's not bread and fish, it's bread and fresh grain. And it's 20 loaves of barley bread. So but it's interesting.
It's pretty cool that you can. Who would have thought that you would get to find that in Second Kings?
Yeah.
That there's a reference to the feeding of the 5,000 there.
Yeah. Very interesting. I think we're going to stop with just this one
Yeah.
chapter.
Okay.
But
Actually, I didn't realize what time it was.
we can pick
We'll
up
pick up Second Kings
Second
again.
Kings, and the next time we'll continue again.
All right. Hold on a
Very
second,
good.
Dan. Let me stop the. Oh, wait. If I
Let
stop
me
this,
stop.
does that end the call?